Good afternoon. It's 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, June 27th. I'm Ray Graff. It's Astronomy Today. We welcome back Bob Berman and Dr. Valerie Rapson to take your calls. If you do have a question about asteroids or comets or the planets or stars or supernovae, give us a call. 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. VoxPop@WAMC.org. That's the email. And the phone number, I'll say it slowly, 800-348-2551. Astronomy Today with Bob Berman and Valerie Rapson. And you will be back after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. It's Astronomy Today, and it's been an interesting lead into the program here in Studio A. We won't bring any of that up. We'll talk about the heavens today with Bob Berman, who is the astronomy editor for the Old Farmer's Almanac, a contributing editor at Astronomy Magazine, the author of about a dozen books. Dr. Valerie Rapson is assistant professor of physics and astronomy at SUNY Oneonta. She earned her PhD in astrophysical science and technology at RIT. If you have a question for this duo, give us a call. 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. You can also email us at voxpop@wamc.org. VoxPop@WAMC.org. That's the email address. The number is 800-348-2551. Valerie Rapson, how are you?
Oh, I'm doing great. How are you?
You ready to run out of the studio screaming yet?
No, not yet.
We've all had a lovely chat. Bob Berman, how are you?
I'm good. We just had a nice packed observatory visit. People paid for an auction for a good cause.
Okay.
And so we had a nice crowded... Session under the stars, boy. That's so great.
That's nice. Mm-hmm.
The weather's been pretty good recently, hasn't it, for observing?
Yeah, for observing, and we've even gotten enough rain so that everyone who's into plants, which is most of us, aren't worrying too much.
Oh, that's good. Well, you know, I had heard yesterday, and I didn't see any follow-up in the news, and maybe it isn't true, that solar flare, the sunspot that's been causing all the mayhem, is once again facing us. Is that true?
It's back.
Yeah.
It's
wow.
Back. It's small, but it's back.
Third time around, yeah?
Yeah, and that like hardly ever happens because, you know, usually these things last a few days, maybe a week, and, you know, the sun's rotation is almost a month in certain spots. So this is really rare for it to hang on that long.
Well, you know, June 30th coming up. International Asteroid Day. Did you know that?
Good date for it.
Yeah. Okay, Bob, I know why. It's in the article here. Why is it?
Because that was the date that the Tunguska event happened, June 30th of 1908.
Yes.
When a guy, Semenov was his last name, but I've forgotten his first name, a Russian just sitting on his porch many miles away, was blown across his property by the impact, and trees were flattened for 50 miles in all directions just because this thing blew up in the air. Now, we're only talking about an object a few hundred feet across, smaller than the objects that are going to be passing us in the next few days. But this is, it did that kind of destruction, similar, by the way, to what happened on February 15th, 2013, when a similar size object blew up 18 miles in the air over Chelyabinsk, also in Siberia. That seems to be ground zero for these things. And unfortunately, people rushed to windows to see that white line across the sky, and the windows blew out. And that's why 1,000 people were injured. Mm.
Okay. Well, understandably, some of the press is getting us very excited. And this was in the New York Post today. Planet killer asteroid will be one of the closest asteroids to plunge past planet Earth this year. Valerie, how scared should I be?
Not scared at all, but it is always fun to read those article titles. You know, they're trying to panic everybody. But, you know, the reality is, there's a big rock coming nearby, but it's going to be, you know, thousands, really tens of thousands, if not 100,000 miles away from Earth. And it's important that we watch these things and that we track their orbits just in case one does come towards us. But these rocks are going to fly safely by us. They're a few hundred feet wide, and they're really going to pose no danger. But if you do have a small telescope, telescope, you might be able to catch it if you look in the right place at the right time.
Okay, so we're okay.
Yeah, we're going to be fine.
Bob, and funny, you know, I printed that article, and then you sent a few minutes later this email about how the government would never hide an extinction-level event if an asteroid was on a dead course for us. And you worked for years with these global online observatories, right?
Yeah, that was always the most popular event when we'd have an NEO, a near-Earth object, passing nearby. We have three observatories, 1 meter range on the Tenerife Islands, Canary Islands, and in Australia. And we'd track them. And we'd have over a million visitors sometimes, and you know what they would say, because I was the online astronomer listening to their questions. People thought that they could trust us to tell them the truth if there was real danger, but they thought the government would lie and hide it if one was actually on a collision course. And I'm convinced that widespread belief was the core motivation for them making the movie Don't Look Up a couple of years ago, where that's the theme. The government, we have an extinction level event. The government is lying to us. But because I sat on the inside and also know people in the government who work on these things, I can tell you there's no mechanism in place for that to happen. And during the 17 years that I was the columnist every month in Discover magazine, we sometimes published pretty on-the-edge articles, for example, about the capabilities of the KH-11 spy satellite and things that we thought, oh, we're going to get a phone call saying, kill that story, you can't reveal it.
That's because you were probably wrong.
But the government never stepped in, and I don't know any mechanism by which they could. And also, astronomers tend to be blabbermouths. All professional astronomers I know,
I agree.
They're going to pick up the phone and they're going to say, Bill, you won't believe this, but this, they'll give the name of it and its location. They'll say, it's on a collision course with Earth for 3 weeks from now. And then that person's going to tell not only their girlfriend and their wives and a million other people, but other astronomers. And by the time the government even starts hearing about it, it's out there in the world. So it's just not going to be kept hidden.
All right. Valerie, you agree?
I think so. I mean, it'd be really hard to keep these secrets. You know, there's too many people that would have to keep the secret. And Bob's right. You know, I hear about all sorts of cool things from all the astronomy forums that I'm on. And, you know, half the time the amateur astronomers have observed something way before a professional astronomer has had the chance to look at it. So we would definitely know. Word would get out.
Well, part of this article in the Post about the planet killer asteroid, which I guess is fine, there's another one much smaller. This is, I think, 492 feet across.
That's not bad.
And it was only discovered a week ago. And so that's what scares me, is that there are things flying out there that have come relatively close, maybe between Earth and the moon at times, that we don't even know they're there.
I mean, they're so small and dark, it's really hard to see them. And, you know, we envision astronomers and, you know, we're constantly looking at the stars, but the sky is so big and we can't watch every position at every moment in time and find everything. So it has to get close enough to us to be bright enough to be obvious.
One good example of what Valerie's saying is that on February 15th, 2013, at SLU, the online observatory, we had scheduled a program tracking a known inbound, and it was going to be, of course, about as far away as the moon, so no danger to us, but we were tracking it. That was the day when, unknown to us, coming from the opposite direction, the sunward direction, where you can't see it coming, another object came in, and that was the one that blew up over Chelyabinsk, Siberia, and caused 1,000 injuries from broken glass. And so two on the same day, one we knew about and the other we didn't even know until it blew up.
Right. Now, you had mentioned that there was a similar size to the Tunguska event of 1908. I mean, I've seen the pictures, basically trees down in a radial pattern.
That's right. 50 miles across. Yeah.
You know, signifying an airburst. And I think that time there was a time they thought it was a comet, right?
Well, yeah, you know, we're not that up on detonations. We know that that one over Chelyabinsk was equal to about 18 Hiroshima-type A-bomb explosions. We know the approximate intensity, but because speed, you know, an explosion is mass times velocity squared. So the speed is more important than the size of the object when it comes to how much energy it's going to release upon impact or hitting our atmosphere. And so it's very important. So the direction it comes from really determines the speed. Is it traveling in the same direction we are? We're going 18 and a half miles a second. So an object orbiting the way planets and most asteroids do is not going to come in very fast. But comets, the sky's the limit. They come in from every direction and at every speed.
Yeah. It's Astronomy Today with Bob Berman and Valerie Rapson. We have to take a break in about 2 minutes. The number here is 800-348-2551. And then, Valerie, you sent this one. And it seems like it's all Greek to me. Citizen scientists discover hypervelocity L subdwarf star in solar neighborhood. Valerie, okay. What are you talking about?
They put a lot of science-y words in the title, but it's actually pretty simple. There's this program called Backyard Worlds, Planet 9, where basically the average person can go online and help look at pictures and basically see if any objects move against the background stars or something moves particularly fast. And some people spotted a hypervelocity star, which is a fancy word for a star that is moving really fast, and it's only a couple hundred light years away. So this tells us that this star probably got kicked out of a system, like maybe a supernova went off and it pushed it out, or it interacted with some stars in a star cluster. But it's kind of neat because the star is relatively close. Usually we see these types of things, you know, more at the edge of the galaxy rather than roughly in the solar neighborhood. And we think it's on its way out of the Milky Way. The current trajectory says, you know, it's going to take thousands and thousands of years to get there, but eventually it might actually leave our galaxy and just kind of be in intergalactic space.
You know, I've heard of rogue planets that are sort of maybe the star is gone and they're floating in space. Yeah. There are rogue stars as well that just sort of float along.
It's kind of the same idea because, you know, anytime it interacts with another object or there's a big gravitational push or pull, you know, these stars can basically get kicked out of their systems and we spot them as just really fast moving objects. They're sometimes mistaken for, you know, asteroids until we really look at them more and realize that they're farther away and have stellar properties to them.
And what Valerie's saying about speed is very, very cool and very correct in that there are restrictions and limitations to speed. For example, here in our own solar system, if you've been expelled from Earth, you're talking about 8 miles a second to escape from Earth. But to escape from the sun, you need about 320 miles a second. Mm. So if you have an object that's orbiting around the sun and is no longer in its grasp, that tells you something that it's not a normal situation that happened. There had to be some other push, some other
collision or whatnot.
Yeah. So when it comes to objects in our galaxy, there's a certain speed, which means it could not have been from our galaxy. It's a visitor from somewhere else because at a certain speed, you can't remain in our galaxy. You've exceeded the escape velocity of the galaxy itself.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's take a quick break here. It's Astronomy with Bob Berman at Valerie Rapson. The number is 800-348-2551. Or you can email us, voxpop@wamc.org. Tommy Dorsey and the Orchestra from 1944, 1945, Opus 1. 800-348-2551 is the number. It's Astronomy Today with Bob Berman and Valerie Rapson. And before we hit the emails and the calls, you mentioned something, Valerie, that I did not know about International Asteroid Day.
Yeah, Brian May, the guitarist of Queen, is a huge proponent of Asteroid Day. I can't quite remember if he officially started it or if he's just been promoting it a lot, but, you know.
He has a PhD,
He does have a PhD in astrophysics. So, you know, there's a huge history of scientists and astronomers also being musicians, both in current day and, you know, hundreds of years ago. But he's, we should all listen to some Queen music on the 30th,
you
is
know,
what I'm trying to say.
It's so interesting. Usually it's the other way around from usual. Usually, you know, if you're in a band, you have to have a day job.
Right.
He made a lot of money in his band,
right.
And he's got a day job.
Yeah.
That's amazing. 800-348-2551 is the number. Email is voxpop@wamc.org. This email from Matt. What do you guys think about the excessive number of Starlink satellites in orbit? Well, I know the answer to this, and all the other potentially similar ones to be launched in the future.
Yeah, these are always an annoyance to astronomers. And, you know, it's great that we are promoting internet access across the world. Like, I'm all for that. But all of these satellites going up there, they're definitely getting in the way of our observing. And there was recently an article about how deorbiting them and all of the metals, especially the aluminum that are components of these satellites, you know, they interact with our ozone layer and they might start to negate some of the repairs that we've had to the ozone hole over the years as we start to deorbit them. So I'm not, you know, 100% against them. We're trying to make them darker and not be in our way, but we just really have to think through all the consequences and try and balance them with the benefits.
My feeling is bad news, good news. To me, it's not bad news whether they're there or not, because I'm the only person that you know, or that probably any of our listeners know, who has never owned a cell phone. So let all these Starlink thousands of satellites be there so that the whole world can look at their screens, even if they're in the middle of the Amazon jungle. And most astronomers, I agree with Valerie, would rather it not happen. But here's the good news part of it. You only can see a satellite when it's in sunlight. So, and it'll only be in sunlight during the first couple of hours after nightfall or before dawn. And so in the middle of the night, especially in the winter, where it's dark up there almost the whole night. But even at this time of year, the middle section of the night remains blissfully dark, and we don't see these things.
Yeah, it's more the professional observatories that have the struggle, because, like, those early evenings and mornings, like, that's when they're observing and they're getting, you know, their calibrations ready. And there have been some studies that, like, you know, we'll lose about 30% of our observing time during those frames when the satellites will be in the way.
Well, this email from Glenn in Woodstock, the subject heading is Lunar Major Standstill. Glenn writes, are we there? Please explain the 18.6-year cycle.
Oh, well, what happens is that it's not just the moon going around the Earth, which it does in 27.32166 days, but the orbit itself makes a rotation around us in a lot of different ways. For example, the tilt of its orbit rotates, but in a counterclockwise way to the way the moon actually moves. So because of this, in that 18.6-year cycle, you'll have a recurrence of eclipses. You'll have an occurrence of how high and low the moon can be. Now, here's where it affects observing. If that moon's path, which is 5 degrees offset from the sun's position as it goes through the constellations, called the ecliptic, that's the path of the sun, the moon's is 5 degrees offset. But which way? Now, it's rare for the moon's highest point, which is on the Gemini-Taurus border, to correspond with the sun's highest point. And that only happens every 18.6 years. But when it does that, it stops getting as high up as it can get, and then starts becoming more moderate. That's called the standstill. And we're just about there at that standstill period. The opposite is also true. We're having extremely low moons. Now, the lowest moon is around the time of the summer solstice. So we just had that. The full moon of June was so low that it barely cleared hills and houses for most people. And but those extremes are just about reaching its limit, and we're going to reach the end of that. That's called the lunar standstill, because it stops getting more and more extreme and goes back to a more reasonable position in the sky.
All right. Val, you want to add anything?
No, that was perfect.
800-348-2551 is the number. Dr. Valerie Rapson is here. Bob Berman is here. It's astronomy, and let's go to the phones. And Brian is in Saratoga. Brian, you're on.
Hey, Ray.
Hey, you're on.
Hey, Bob. Hey, Val. Thanks for taking my call.
I got
a softball question for you. And Bob, just so you know, you're talking to somebody who's never owned a cell phone, so I'm not contributing.
Nice.
To
hey, one more person. Great.
Well,
Bob knows, or Ray knows, I mentioned last time, I'm a Luddite, so
yeah, no
won't
problem.
Go there.
I'm with you.
I have a question that's got three small parts to it, and I'll ask it, and then I'll hang up.
All right.
If that's cool.
You got it.
First is the age of the universe, the age of the Earth, and how science has come up with that conclusion.
Okay, age of the Earth, age of the universe, and how science figured that out. Mm-hmm. Brian, thank you very much for the call. What do you think? Value start.
Well, we've got about 13.8 billion years for the age of the universe, and we've got about 4.5 billion years for the age of the Earth, 4 or 4.5, depending on, you know, whether you're talking about the solar system, the sun, the Earth, you know, you can get nitpicky there. But there's a variety of ways that we can figure this out. You know, we can look at distant objects in space. We can look at supernova, the cosmic microwave background. And we can make distance measurements, and knowing the speed of light, that basically gives us a time measurement as well. So we can get a sense of kind of the age of the universe. And then looking at our Earth, you know, we can do things from an astronomical perspective. We can measure the sun. We can understand the life cycle of the sun, get an age of the solar system. And then being on our planet, we can actually do, you know, geologic sampling. We can do carbon dating for different things and get the different ages and various changes in our planet over time, and estimate that the overall age is about 4 or 4.5 billion years.
True. Everything Valerie said is absolutely true. There's one other aspect to consider.
Sure.
And that is, Neil deGrasse Tyson likes to give lectures for, and I don't blame him, for atheist groups, where he says that you shouldn't believe in things you can't prove or observe. Like if somebody said, oh, yeah, I saw a rabbit and it just popped out of nothingness, he would say, well, here's somebody that you just ignore because that can't happen. Instead, you should trust science. But science says, as Valerie just said, that it 13.8 billion years ago, the entire universe popped out of nothingness. Now, how did it do that? We say we have no idea. What preceded it? What were the antecedent conditions that allowed a universe to pop out of nothingness? We say we have no idea. So we believe that everything popped out of nothingness. At least some of us are skeptical about that and say, well, this may mean that there's stuff we don't know, that there's unknown factors at play. And one of the possibilities is that the universe is infinite, or let's put it this way, eternal, time-wise, that it did not have a birth, that instead, and we have problems with that because no human mind can visualize eternity or infinity, but nonetheless, since nothing makes sense otherwise, it's still possible that the universe is eternal. And so when the caller asked us about the age of the universe, keep that in mind, that's not been excluded.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's the beauty of science. And, like, I love that mystery of, you know, we still have a lot more to figure out. And, you know, we have observations that point in one direction towards one theory and one number. But we have to be honest with ourselves. That's going to change. And it is changing. I mean, we can get into the debate. Is it 13.8 or 14.0 or 13.6? Like, we can get nitpicky, but The science is kind of pointing in one direction, but we have to be open-minded about what we don't yet understand and be willing to make changes as we discover new things.
Explain to me, or explain to us, the microwave background and why it is thought that this is evidence of a Big Bang or something like that in creation.
At a certain point early in the universe stopped being opaque. Before that, nothing could travel through. Light of any kind could not travel. When neutral atoms first formed, and that's the event 13.8 billion years ago, when they first formed, the nature of that is, and it formed everywhere at once, because there's no reason there'd be a privileged position where that would happen. That would mean that some areas are hotter than others. There's no reason that should have happened. So all at once, when neutral atoms formed, mostly hydrogen, the universe got transparent. And at that point, the brilliant energy that at that time was mostly X-rays and gamma rays could travel freely through space. But because the universe was expanding then and continues to expand, all those waves have lengthened. And as we all know, once you have waves lengthened, they change their nature. And when you say the microwave background, Ray, the reason it's a microwave background is the rays have so expanded, because when you're talking about gamma rays, you're talking about a trillion of them that it will exist in an inch, whereas microwaves can be a mile apart from wave crest to wave crest. So these waves have expanded so much that right now what we can detect only, the only thing that's there that used to be much more energetic, electromagnetic radiation, is now microwaves.
800-348-2551. All of that's very nice. Valerie, how does one go about proving that?
Well, we can observe the cosmic background with our cosmic microwave background with our space telescopes and detect this kind of ambient signal that's everywhere. But the reason that it kind of points to this idea of the Big Bang is, you know, we have models that say, well, if the universe was essentially infinitely small and then it expands at a certain rate over a certain amount of time, that's what's going to stretch the photons, as Bob said. So if we are about 13.8 billion years after this point, the photons would stretch to the wavelength they are now. They would give this 2.3 Kelvin temperature. So it all kind of meshes together.
What is the wavelength? In other words, what microwave, to me, microwave, you know, 23 centimeters. They're very small. They're not miles
That's
long.
That's right. They're radio waves. They're just a form of radio waves.
Are they actual microwaves, or is that what astronomers call them?
No,
microwaves are very small. It sounds to me like what you're describing is long waves.
No. Even radio, it's a part of the radio spectrum.
No, I understand.
And these waves can be as much as miles apart. They can also be a foot apart. Mm-hmm. There's a big range of size. You're right, Ray.
Well, I mean,
but they can be a mile from wave crest to wave crest. So, but we have detectors that are designed to detect whatever we're getting. The real weird thing is the evenness of this energy, that wherever we look in space, we're looking for an anisotropy, which means a difference from one spot to another. And you know what? There is not a difference of even one part in 50,000, which means we have an evenness in all directions. And that alone tells us volumes about what it must have been like when these energies first started out. They also tell us that those little bit of anisotropies, that little one part in 50,000, that's a little hotter or colder, that means waves are more intense than other places, were probably the incipient seeding or starting points of stars and galaxies.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the earliest first step in what we see today. And the stars and galaxies today were these slight irregularities in that cosmic background. So it gives us volumes of information.
Okay.
Right. Oh, I was just going to say, to specifically answer your question, 160 gigahertz is the frequency.
160 gigahertz.
Yeah, I had to look it up because I know it is 2.7 Kelvin. You know, you can convert it to frequencies.
Right, but they can't be miles apart then. Those are tiny little waves. They're tiny waves. In other words, the commercial radio band is in VHF, right? And it might be the wave height might be a foot and a half, or it might be 2.5 meters.
No, we're not talking about height here. We're talking about length from wave crest to wave crest.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's take one more call before the next break. It's Astronomy with Bob Berman and Valerie Rapson. Let's go to Who's the Tonic? It's Chris. Hello, you're on.
Yeah, Valerie and Bob, I got a couple of questions for you. I just saw, I read recently that, and I don't know, Valerie doesn't like to talk about this, but I read it online someplace that there might be aliens in the moon.
Oh, boy. Mm.
And also, can reconnaissance planes like the Blackbird take photos in space, because I know the Blackbird can go high. And lastly, can lightning have different colors?
Can lightning have... Well, Chris, you're really covering the gamut here. First, let's tackle the aliens in the moon.
I'm going to say no aliens on the moon, despite some of my favorite TV shows and movies that suggest otherwise. But no, we've seen no strong evidence for that with all the satellites. And, you know, the recent Chinese mission is bringing some rocks back from the other side, which is really cool. So we know a lot about the moon, but we don't think there's any aliens.
They would have
there.
To live in the lava tubes, right?
Yeah, they'd have to be underneath. They'd have to be really well hidden.
Okay. And then the next one is about the SR-71. Can it take pictures in space? I guess it depends on which way they aim the camera, right?
You're looking at me?
I don't know. You know, the next one is lightning, different colors. Quickly. Anybody?
Well, I mean, we're primarily going to see it as kind of white-yellow because we're just seeing, you know, the flashes of all the visible wavelengths of light. So we don't tend to see it as different colors on our planet, but we do see some flashes on other planets, which is really neat. Like Venus, we've seen some lightning, and Jupiter. So it's not a phenomenon that's unique to Earth.
And I think you make a great point. And thank you for the call, Chris. Lightning, of course, generates it's extremely dirty. It'll send RF all across the spectrum, and you can tell by listening to an AM radio and tuning it to a distant station when there's a thunderstorm, even 100 miles away, you'll hear that crackle of the lightning.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so Chris, thanks. Let's take a break. 800-3, we'll reset. 800-348-2551 is the number. It's Astronomy Today. Bob Berman, Valerie Rapson, and you. Astronomy is nice work if you can get it. 800-348-2551 is the number. 800-348-2551. Bob was, he's on a soapbox about how we Americans say Jupiter.
Well, I'm not against it or for it, but I just noticed that Valerie just said Jupiter, and I say Jupiter, and that everyone I know pronounces it as if it were a D, not a T in the word. And I wondered whether one should, if you're doing radio and you want to pronounce things correctly, whether we should say Jupiter or whether that sounds pompous and affected and we shouldn't bother.
Well, let's put it to our listeners. 800-348-2551. Should Bob be more pompous and affected? Let's find out. 800-348-2551. Let's go to New Paltz. James, you're on.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
First of all, yes, be more pompous and effective.
Well, you see, there's one vote. Okay, good.
right off the bat. Second question, had the privilege of witnessing the solar eclipse up in Shelburne, Vermont, thanks to WAMC and my donation.
Nice.
I have to say, I thought that it was going to get a lot darker when totality occurred. So I was a little disappointed by that. But the thing I found the most fascinating is when totality occurred, there were these little red bulbous protrusions.
That
were emanating from the disk, which to me was the most spectacular part of the whole event. They were very intense. They were very red. I was just wondering, what are they, and are they related to the recent increase in solar flare activity?
Mm-hmm.
And my last question is, what I can kind of get my head around infinite largeness when we're all talking about the universe, the expansion of it, and so forth. What I can't get my head around is infinitely small.
Wow.
I can, for some reason, get infinitely big. Like, I can understand how things can be infinitely large beyond our, but how can something be infinitely small?
Like, one point. I dig that.
My pathetic brain cannot process that.
All right, so solar eclipse, the little pearls or whatever they call them, Bob.
Yeah, well, I'm going to start at the last point first. You're not alone, caller, because many astrophysicists and physicists say that when it comes to infinitely small, for example, a singularity is supposedly becomes infinitely smaller. In other words, you're getting a black hole that's collapsing, it gets smaller and smaller. And if you follow Einstein's general relativity, it takes you to infinitely small and infinitely dense. But many say there can't be anything in the physical world that has no space.
Mm.
There can't be anything in the physical world that's infinitely dense. And therefore, these are concepts that are mathematical, perhaps, or physics, perhaps, but not don't have analogs in the actual natural physical world. And some say, and because of that, there must be a process that prevents that from happening. Some say, for example, perhaps the strong force, which ordinarily doesn't act that way, nonetheless steps in when a singularity is collapsing and stops its collapse at a certain point because, like you, they can't wrap their heads around infinite smallness, and actually neither can I. Now, when it comes to the eclipse, I'm so glad that you went there. Many people think that the draw is darkness during the day, but the real draw are the effects such as what you described, prominences and the corona, seeing the sun's actual atmosphere being made visible. And it brings tears to about, in the 54 years that I've been leading eclipse tours around the world, about half of the people weep from the emotional impact of it.
James, did you weep?
And I haven't, but I've watched.
I didn't weep, but my jaw did drop a bit.
All right. So there it is. So, but I don't think anybody weeps because it got dark. I mean, if you want dark, you could just go in a closet.
Right.
It's not an exceptional experience to have darkness. So it's those other things. And I'm so glad you went to a place in Vermont, in your case, that actually was clear, because too many people, I know other people that went to, let's say, Geneseo, for example, where it was actually drizzling, where it was rainy and overcast.
Oh, perfect.
And so it was by no means guaranteed. Even in Texas, our group of 78 people, we saw about 15 seconds of the 4 minutes that were potentially visible, because it was so cloudy that we only saw the total eclipse sun pop out for a few seconds here and there and here and there. So you were in a clear spot, I believe, if I'm not mistaken. And congratulations!
Yeah, we got the full experience up there in Shelburne.
Nice.
Valerie.
And yeah, I just wanted to add, too, that those red things that I think you were talking about were probably the prominences on the edge of the sun, where you have the plasma that can be lifted off the sun by the magnetic fields, and they look really small, you know, compared to the sun in the sky, but they're actually, you know, hundreds of thousands of miles above the surface.
Cool.
And it is related to the fact that we're heading towards the peak of solar activity. So the fact that an eclipse coincided with that means that the view was extra spectacular.
Hey, James, thanks for the call. It's Astronomy Today with Valerie Rapson and Bob Berman. 800-348-2551 is the number. To Guilford, Connecticut, it's Terry. Terry, go ahead.
Hi. In regard to the microwaves, they're actually, like Ray was saying, there is like nuance in the description or nomenclature of different radio bands, and the microwave is generally regarded as above 1,000 megahertz, which is the same as 1 gigahertz. Mm-hmm. Just another way of saying it. And below that, you have like, it's the middle of UHF is where you go from like short radio waves over to microwave. And I'm a ham radio operator.
There
I'm not
go.
Very active anymore. But you go down, like, we also operate in the HF band, which goes from 3 megahertz to 30 megahertz. Mm-hmm. And in that range, you get a lot of ionospheric activity,
right,
which are affected or afflicted by the sun and the magnetic field of the Earth also, and the way they interact together.
Hmm.
And they even have, recently, they've opened up some bands in the LF range, a long wave, which is actually below AM radio broadcast band,
yep,
which is also known as medium wave.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it's true,
just
man.
To throw that in there.
Well, thank you. And by the way, while we're talking about radio, and Terry, thanks for the call, anybody know what the frequency of hydrogen is? It's in the UHF band.
We usually say 21 centimeters.
Okay.
We like to say that because that's what we detect when we're looking for spiral arms in our galaxy.
Why is it that SETI decided years ago in the 60s that this was a good frequency to park on and listen? Why would that frequency?
Well, I mean, hydrogen is so basic, right? We have figured out the properties of hydrogen, and the idea is that if there are intelligent beings at least as intelligent as we are, they may have figured that out as well. And if they were going to choose any frequency that you could imagine to send a signal at, they might choose something that they think another species could relate to. So they often look at the hydrogen frequencies. They look at like the water frequencies to think about, you know, importance and knowledge and understanding. So that's why they did that. You know, we're kind of ignoring the scientific aspect of hydrogen and just thinking about how one might intelligently communicate. And that's a good one to pick.
All right, let's go back to our phones. Valerie Rapson is here, 800-348-2551. Bob Berman as well. Let's go to Richmond, Massachusetts. Francis, you're on.
Assuming the Big Bang theory that sent matter in all directions from the point of the Big Bang, does that mean that behind this ever-expanding movement of matter in an outward direction, it's leaving behind an ever-expanding spherical void? And if that's the case, is that something that can be detected or even seen?
Yeah, so not quite. It's the better way to think about it is, you know, the initial Big Bang is more of a burst of energy. You know, physical matter like atoms that we see today didn't come till much, much later. The universe had to cool off and actually create this material. So it's not like a typical explosion where we think about actual material moving outward. It's this push force and the universe is stretching and energy is expanding outward and matter and things are created along the way. So there isn't really this wall that, you know, is going to hit things as it goes. We're just going to see new material created as time goes on.
May I add to that?
Certainly, yes.
That don't think of it the way we think of a normal explosion. When you think of an unfortunate war or something, and there's the detonation of a shell, you have material racing away, and behind it, there's emptiness because nothing further is being blasted out. That's not what the Big Bang is quite different from that, in that it occurred everywhere at that time, which was that everywhere was only a point source, essentially, back then, but it's still everywhere. So there's no place that if you look back from that place, you get to the emptiness behind the expansion. The expansion is still occurring. It's still equally everywhere. It's right here as much as it's a million light years from here. And nothing is leaving behind an empty place where it's not happening. So
okay.
The analogy with explosions that we've seen in movies and stuff is not really that apt.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for that call. This email from Ken in Massachusetts and Palmer. Can you share your perspectives on the object that astrophysicist Avi Loeb described as something possibly made by alien technology?
That's Oumuamua, yes?
I think, yeah. Well, there's several. I think there are some little spheres that they found at the bottom of the ocean, which might also be what Ken is referring to. But let's go with Oumuamua.
Yeah, I mean, any of those kind of things. I mean, I'm all up for speculation until we know more, right? So whether they are things we're finding on Earth or things we're finding in outer space, we really need to gather enough data and information to be confident before we claim that, you know, spheres have been dropped to Earth or whatever it is. So we have to study it in a little bit more depth. They definitely pose some questions that we don't think we have answers to yet.
And that's what Occam's Razor is for. Occam's Razor,
sure.
To Simpler. Remind everybody, is that better. The simplest explanation is usually the correct one. Like if your car doesn't start in the morning, you should first think that maybe you left the lights on or the battery is run down.
Took the energy out?
No, yeah. Your first thought shouldn't be that a meteorite has struck the electronic ignition system, disabling it. You start with the simplest and the most likely first. So if you find something weird at the bottom of the ocean, your first thought shouldn't be, oh, aliens created that, and let's consider
I
that.
I agree, and I'm sure that Occam had a very close shave. But this is a Harvard astrophysicist. He's not some nut, right? I'm
you
sure
know,
there's
of,
more.
Some of the smartest people I know have been nuts, really, and you too.
Well, I know for a fact, and especially with those spheres, that they are unique. They are different. You know, we've checked off the boxes and said, you know, this is not like anything we have ever seen before. But until we can officially prove that material is actually from space, I have to remain a little bit skeptical.
I think he is too. Yeah,
maybe. I don't know.
Okay, well, let's get him on the show. Let's go to Chris in New Paltz. Chris, you're on.
Hi, thanks for taking the call. Quickly, before I get to my question, I just want to give a wave to that earlier caller. Myself and two companions over a 24-hour period drove 925 miles
wow.
on eclipse day
nice.
Using weather radar apps and direct observation to end up in Shelburne, Vermont.
How about that?
Good for you.
It was wonderful to see. This is my second eclipse, and you talked about people weeping. My dear brother, who I insisted come with me, just burst into tears. It's
wow.
just so remarkable.
Excellent.
Okay, my question quick. I know we're getting near the end of the
yes.
hour. When you see a light beam, like a laser or something like that, it has a great deal of focus, but I would imagine that over time that focus begins to fade and the beam gets, say, wider, perhaps. So my question is, you've got a star that is 1,500 light years away from Earth, and yet when we look up at it, it still looks like a pinpoint source.
Mm-hmm.
So how does that beam like continue to be that coherent over that huge amount of distance?
Right. The construction of light. Let's talk about that.
I mean, you're exactly right. Light does spread out, one over the distance squared. You know, that's how much it spreads out over time. And when we see stars, you know, they are so tremendously bright, and we are getting so much energy that the light that is directly beamed in our direction is the light we are actually seeing. Light is traveling in all directions, but it's getting dispersed, and we are seeing the concentrated light that is exactly towards the star, and that's why they appear to be so precise. You know, nothing is really focusing the light. It's just the fact that, you know, we're seeing what's coming directly at us at the highest intensity.
And it's so small.
So it's really,
the bottom
like
line is it's so small relative to the sky
sure.
that it has to be a point source with no dimension that we can detect.
Right. If we look at planets, that's not the case, right? We can actually see them as spheres, especially with a small telescope. But the stars are so distant, that you only see the speck of light.
But you can see it get wider. I mean, that's why stars twinkle and planets tend not to, because
I thought that was the atmosphere.
It is. Exactly. But that's the light being interfered with and spreading out. And if you've got, as Valerie just said, more of a disk size, then you're not going to get that. You'll still see it as a coherent shape.
Okay. Chris, thanks a lot. Very quickly, let's go to Terry and Troy. Terry, you have about 30 seconds to pose this thought.
Okay. It's just more of a comment for the gentleman that was trying to conceptualize infinite smallness.
Okay.
Just like infinite largeness, we can take one and follow it by any number of zeros and just keep adding zeros and adding zeros, and the number will become infinitely large. Mm-hmm. So to the left side of the decimal point, if we have 0.1, 0.01, 0.001, if we keep adding zeros, we can make that infinitely small. In addition, there's also the idea of Zeno's paradox of motion, wherein to cross any distance, you first have to cross half that distance, half mm-hmm. of that distance, half of that distance, and so on into infinity. So to cross any distance, you have to cross infinite halves.
So you'll never get where you're going.
Correct.
Interesting.
Yes, but these are ways of conceptualizing smallness and representing with your decimal point and zeros. You're quite right, but you're talking about how you represent the smallness, not whether or not it can actually exist as a physical object in nature.
Uh-huh. Well, Terry, unfortunately, the paradox will have to stop because we have actually reached the end of this, so we're done with the show. Bob Berman, thank you for being here. How do people follow up on your comings and goings?
Thank you. Just Bob Berman Tours would do it.
All right. And Valerie Rapson,
yes.
SUNY Oneonta, and everything happening.
We've got planetarium shows every Saturday. Bring your family, bring your kids, come visit me.
All right, all. Thank you for being here. Support comes from Ambrose Electric Standby Power, an electrical contractor providing sales service and installation of residential and commercial Generac automatic standby generators, serving the greater Capital District for over 40 years. AmbroseLEC.com. And the FDR Presidential Library at Museum Hyde Park. Now on view, the exhibit Black Americans, Civil Rights and the Roosevelts, 1932 to 1962. A look at racial justice in America during and after the Great Depression and World War II. FDRLibrary.org. Once again, thanks to Bob Berman and Dr. Valerie Rapson for being here. Thank you for listening. Some very thoughtful and interesting calls, even the one about the aliens in the moon. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. Phone screened by Susie Checkeye. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, today's what, Thursday? Tomorrow, it's a Food Friday, and we will talk ice cream. That's right, ice cream. We'll see you tomorrow at 2.